In 1999, when I was recruited by Ed Beauvais, who's here today, to the University of Michigan for my position at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, he spoke of my new role, leading adult cardiac surgery at the University of Michigan, providing a distinct pulpit or podium or stage for me. But I certainly never considered or thought about this stage, nor do I suspect Ed Beauvais did either. To be president of a society representing our specialty is a unique honor, offering insights, opportunities, challenges, and wonderful moments with friends and colleagues here and around the world. Today, let me start first, actually, by acknowledging a group that was already acknowledged this morning, but more are here for this presidential address. This is Rob Winbrandt and the talented senior staff, many of whom are on our weekly calls that, while Bill Baumgartner had set up an hour weekly calls, ours never finished before an hour and a half to 2.5 hours in this era. And these people basically provide the efforts and have created the team behind us in organizations such as the STS, who facilitate all the advancements of our goals. A personal thank you to all of you here, as well as your colleagues in Chicago and Washington. The STS has had a very busy year, and not just because the offices are moving in February, or because we're actively representing the voice of cardiac and thoracic surgery in this transformative time in Washington. In late 2017, as most of you know, Intermax became a part of the STS database, enabling UAB to be a new STS analytics center. We also continue to be involved with broad efforts to enhance the database, as you, our members, are an important voice in this, noting a meeting in Boston this past fall with the congenital cardiac surgeons to discuss analytic approaches and reporting methodologies. Recognizing also technologic and software advances, the databases have a goal to lessen data acquisition burden, create more facile upgrades, acknowledging we must, however, capture innovative approaches that advance our armamentarium, always a challenging balance, as you know. Our STS educational platforms continue to expand with our recently redesigned website and its linked internet technologies, our expanded portfolio of topical meetings, and our national and international meetings coordinated with our sister professional societies. It is clear to cardiac and thoracic surgeons worldwide that our interactions with our colleagues in other disciplines provides an opportunity to speak in a more unified voice in the arenas of appropriateness, guidelines, consensus pathways, safety, and quality, and be unified to advance our specialty. Recognizing as a professional society, we have a responsibility to understand diversity and inclusion. We have initiated a task force under Dr. David Cook's leadership to evaluate the society's current makeup and recognize the importance and wisdom of a diverse workforce for the populations we serve. A further focus this year has been expanding the opportunities for our colleagues in anesthesia, advanced practice teams of nurses and physicians assistants, and our perfusionists, and have more places on our task forces and workforces for these professionals. And congratulations to our Thoracic Surgery Foundation this year for initiating a traveling fellowship for our perfusion colleagues. As a Michigan thoracic surgery resident, as Dr. Nauenheim noted, I was well acquainted with the evolution and history of this great society. In 1955, the John Alexander Society was created for the graduates of the University of Michigan Thoracic Surgery Program. And the minutes from the 1963 Alexander meeting detail their support for a totally new national society, and that new society would not be the Alexander Society, as evidenced in Max Chamberlain's letter to thoracic surgeons to become a founder member of the Society for Thoracic Surgeons. As we see, Michigan tradition is rich and prominent in the origins of the STS, and I stand here humbly as the third surgeon, as Keith noted, from the University of Michigan to be president, preceded by Dr. Herbert Sloan and Mark Orringer, an honor I never would have anticipated. From the personal perspective, I was most fortunate to have had a loving, supportive family. My parents, Gertrude Sloat Prager and Jacob Prager, shown in the 1930s photographs, were focused on their children, my sister Claire, 4 years my senior, and me, and our experiences, education, and happiness. Moving from Brooklyn, New York, my birthplace, to New Jersey so my father could start a solo private practice as he tired of hospital administration, offered us the opportunity to grow up in the suburbs. These years brought many opportunities to ride with my father and sit in his car during house calls. I was allowed to carry his doctor's bag and occasionally the portable EKG machine, eventually driving him to house calls on weekends and evenings. My mother ran the household, shuttled us to events. Most of mine, as noted already, consisted of Little League, and I have no idea who that cheerleader was. Let me give you a disclaimer. I never saw that lady. Little League, Babe Ruth League, and tennis matches. My sister Claire, whose interests were much more sophisticated than mine, which really was family etiquette for a total lack of interest in sports, became a confidant and friend. With a group of boys bonding in second grade, as the boys, six guys from Hackensack, recalled as the book, we created true and deep friendships, guiding us through grammar school, junior high, the challenges of high school, and continuing through college, graduate school, and our professional and married lives. These friendships, which continue to this day, were forged competing with each other in sports, in the classrooms, and supporting and challenging each other to continue to pursue and attain new goals. All should be as lucky as I was to have a unique group like this and a most supportive, loving family. My career decisions and evolution certainly were influenced, as Dr. Nauenheim noted, by a Hackensack Hospital summer job during high school, college, and medical school as an operating room technician, washing gloves back then, rolling suture on spindles, cleaning instruments, but most importantly, as a scrub nurse or scrub tech every day on multiple operations. And there my love was born for what I continued to do. After college and medical school, my residency years in general surgery and thoracic surgery at Michigan were not only influenced by the faculty at Michigan with surgeons such as C. Gardner Child III, W.J. Fry, and Jeremiah Turcotte in general surgery, and Herbert Sloan, Doug Barrett, Mark Orringer, Otto Gago, and Marvin Kirsch in cardiac surgery, but by the friendships and enviable excellence of my co-residents. To single out three, acknowledging there were many others, and these three are here today: John Brown and Ed Beauvais, cardiac surgeons who many know, as well as Walter Mack Whitehouse, a vascular surgeon and colleague at St. Joe's. My first position after residency was as an assistant professor in the Department of Cardiac and Thoracic Surgery under Dr. Harvey Bender at Vanderbilt, and with John Hammond, fresh from Duke's 10-year residency. I'm really not sure why it took you so long, John. We joined the faculty together to start our careers. Involved in both cardiac and general thoracic surgical procedures, those years reset the bar once again, but now as an independent faculty member, with the expectation set by Dr. Bender of only excellence as a surgeon. Fortunately, with the superb residence in general surgery and cardiothoracic surgery, probably teaching me more than I taught them, including, to name some, Pat Burney, Richard Agnew, Mike Patrasik, Will Ryan, Vaughn Starnes, Chuck Huddlestone, to name but a few, I survived and had the privilege to be the Vanderbilt surgeon representative on the lung cancer study group and early clinical trials group with luminaries such as Griff Pearson, Mac Holmes, and Bob Ginsberg. Leaving wonderful experiences and friendships, I was invited back to a private practice at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, spending 16 years there in an innovative practice that was, as noted, one of the original four HCFA coronary bypass bundled payment hospitals. Pictured here with the first patient in the demonstration. And I also participated in the expansion of the practice, including early adoption of multiple arterial grafting and the evolution of complex operative valvular procedures, including a homograft and Ross procedure program under the guidance of Dr. Otto Gago, whose abilities and demeanor made it all look easy. The transition back into a full-time academic faculty position at the University of Michigan started with a coffee and tea meeting at the well-known Zingerman's Delicatessen in Ann Arbor in December 1998. And not wanting to rush into a decision, I accepted Dr. Beauvais's offer 6 months later. This new role allowed me to again teach cardiac and thoracic residents and accept a new challenge of an evolving section at a major academic health center in an era of anticipated and necessary change. The era included the creation and building of a cardiovascular center with a unique four-physician leadership model with cardiology, vascular surgery, and cardiac surgery, and including the cardiovascular chief nursing officer and CVC chief administrative officer. The leadership model continues today, over a decade later. Further transitions occurred during this time, including the evolution of our section of cardiac surgery into a department of cardiac surgery, a complex epistemologic process at a major public university, and one in which I was intimately involved as a committee member for the year-long process. During these years, we have experienced considerable growth of our superb faculty in the sections of pediatric cardiovascular surgery, adult cardiovascular surgery, and health services research and quality. With this as background, I have many people to thank. First, my administrative assistant, who is here, Sandy Marshall, who has worked with me for over 17 years, as well as our clinical coordinating nurses, our advanced practice teams, our operating room teams, and our perfusionists. Now, as I considered this moment and reviewed the thoughtful messages of the presidents of our professional societies, I was reminded of the many presidential encouragements to innovation as a vehicle to advance and improve our specialty, that the pace of disruptive innovation has increased, and that while we cannot control the past, the future provides only opportunity. With these understandings, I recall the presidential address 10 years ago in this city by John Meyer. Dr. Meyer discussed the role and responsibility of a profession, referencing a quote defining a profession as, and I quote, "an occupation whose core element is work based upon the mastery of a complex body of knowledge and skills. Its members are governed by codes of ethics and profess a commitment to competency and the promotion of the public good. Professions and their members are accountable to those served and to society." So while these words, which we do not think of or consider on a daily basis, certainly ring true in our minds and consciousness, Dr. Meyer then briefly added, "society also now expects accountability and transparency." And after he said that, it's clear that we are all well aware in the United States and worldwide, change is a constant in the role of governments and agencies in healthcare policies and financing, with ever-expanding expectations of our profession. In our specialty, fortunately, technical innovation is never-ending. However, professional innovation is our responsibility, and recognizing, I believe, we certainly are a creative specialty, I would offer that it is we as surgeons and our professional societies that we all must be the leaders in accountability and transparency. And to do so, we must embrace in advance performance measurement and analytics, performance feedback, and performance improvement. And borrowing the title of a Laura Snyder recent book, you will hear, and unfortunately you will not hear her tomorrow because she is ill, but the address of the title of today's address is Eye of the Beholder, The Reinvention of Seeing. The book is a story of Antony van Leeuwenhoek, cloth salesman, natural philosopher, and probably the first microscopist, and Johann Vermeer, painter and experimenter with the optical device, a camera obscura, Both men lived in the Dutch city of Delft during the same era, and both explored and advanced their worlds and thus our understandings. This morning, I will remind us of the importance of seeing our realities. Cardiac and thoracic surgeons have a unique opportunity with the data we have from our registries in the United States and worldwide to explore our outcomes and comparative performances, and with understanding and feedback, discussion and resetting of approaches and goals, create improvements, knowledge, and benefit patients and hopefully our national healthcare systems. The challenge is creating the moments to see and to have the methodology and energy to recognize the realities, to consider where we wish to be as surgeons, teams, and institutions, and as the profession described 10 years ago, be the owners of the future of accountability, improvement, and eventually transparency. So no, this is not a database talk. It's not about workforces, task forces, version upgrades, data fields, all these things that we're tired of hearing about, EHA, EHR migration, recreational data, even data harmonization. So please don't open your cell phones, no emails, no sports on your cell phones. I'll start by sharing two approaches to measurement, data science, feedback, and improvement. One is a part of our specialty and another a unique one. The first model, which is known to some and Dr. Nauenheim alluded to, is the Michigan Society of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgeons Quality Collaborative. The MSTCVS, as it's known, QC, is a part of our state society, which was founded in 1965. The first president, Cameron Haight, was then head of the section of thoracic surgery at the University of Michigan and was an AATS past president. Robert Jones from Midland, Michigan, who is here today, is the current president. Originally, the society met once a year, often in Detroit, to discuss interesting cases initially focused on lung cancer and tuberculosis. As cardiac surgery grew, case discussions expanded, the society evolved, and the meetings were transitioned to a summer meeting in a resort location in Michigan and included lectures from guest speakers and members. Coincidentally, the era brought dramatic changes with two events in the 1980s. One was the publication of the Dartmouth Atlas in 1986, revealing geographic variation in the utilization of surgical procedures, including coronary bypass. And the second event occurred in March of 1986, when the United States Department of Health and Human Services, HCFHS, the forerunner of CMS, released a list of hospital mortality rates for Medicare coronary bypass patients thought to exceed predicted mortality rates. These two events ushered in the era of outcome sciences, and as many in the audience know, fostered the creation of the STS National Database, with the STS committed to the principle of providing the public with accurate information regarding the outcomes of coronary artery surgery and challenging HCFHS data. Richard Clark chaired the ad hoc committee for the National Database. 2 years after the initiation of the STS National Database, hospitals in northern New England created a cardiovascular disease study group, the NNE, and using their own data, published a paper in JAMA in 1991, concluding that the observed differences in hospital mortality rates among institutions and surgeons in the northern New England area was not solely the result of differences in case mix, and potentially represented differences in unknown aspects of patient care. The surgeons at these seven regional hospitals in the cardiovascular disease study group were led by a Dartmouth evaluative scientist, Jerry O'Connor, and a cardiac surgeon who many know, Bill Nugent. And their conclusion awakened payers, economists, administrators, and themselves to a reality and set the stage for us all. At the same time, a unique dynamic was occurring in the state of Michigan. The Greater Detroit Area Health Council, GDAC, created an initiative for Southeast Michigan to form a regional heart consortium with its own database under GDAC's control to review cardiac surgical results, implying their future role in rating and ranking hospitals and surgeons. Paralleling this, the Leapfrog Group, a national nonprofit of large employers and purchasers, emerged in 2000 to create giant leaps in quality and safety for American healthcare. The bullfrog, or formative force of Leapfrog, was the Detroit, Michigan-based General Motors Corporation Medical Benefits Vice President, and GM at that time was one of the largest corporations in the world with extensive medical expenses. Cardiac surgeons in Michigan championing the 11-year-old SDS database had protracted and complicated discussions with GDEC. Faced with the reality of the major automotive companies in Michigan participating in the Leapfrog initiative and GDAC's mission to create and control cardiac surgical outcomes data, the MSTCVS surgeons decided to initiate a quality collaborative using STS data. And in 2001, this became a reality. And so, in preparation for today's presentation to this scholarly and worldly group, I looked in the dictionary to find a definition of collaboration to set the tone for this talk and found collaboration, an unnatural act practiced by non-consenting adults. Undaunted, the Michigan Society of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgeons gained a new focus after 35 years, the MSTCVS Quality Collaborative, and supported by established senior surgeons pictured here, the growth of the early collaborative was evident, with 100% of the programs participating voluntarily in the STS database and the collaborative within 4 years. Perhaps this is a reflection of what Dr. Joe Caselli noted in his AATS presidential address when he described, and I quote, positive aspects of competition specifically in surgery. This was a part of the group dynamic and the desire to come together. Everyone wished to see where they were in comparison to others. However, as I alluded, it was not always easy. With the commitment of surgeons from the initial 17 sites and the wisdom and support of senior member surgeons, we received our first regional report, somewhat user-unfriendly, and displayed it at a summer meeting in 2002. Interestingly, at the same time, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, the major insurer in our state, created funding for a group of interventional cardiologists at 8 hospitals to build their own database and review complications following percutaneous interventions. Accomplishing that, the Blues initiated conversation with the Michigan Society to partially fund our quality collaborative. But, believing we were smarter than any payer, we refused funding for 4 years, concerned that the Blues would actually control our practices, alter reimbursement based on our outcomes, and wish individual surgeon data. Finally, in 2005, after further discussions, fundings were accepted to finance a coordinating center for our data and to pay participating sites a portion of their data manager salary, creating the philosophy of pay for participation. The collaborative evolved not as centers of excellence or pay for performance, but pay for participation. The messages regarding the data and the individual hospitals were simple, repeated, and focused, with the goal of improving outcomes for all our surgeons at all hospitals. The collaborative utilizes large-scale group processes to turn data into information, into action for improvement. This is done real-time with a goal of creating a community of learners. And while we hear the drumbeat, if you will, of machine learning and artificial intelligence, it is not the computers that become more accurate. It's the human deciders, our surgeons and their teams. During the growth of the collaborative, it became obvious we were inhibited by the encrypted STS reports, making it cumbersome to break the alphabetic code to identify performers to discuss their results. And in 2009, it was decided to display the data which each hospital in the state identified specifically. We unblinded our data. This slide shows the percentage of coronary bypass procedures per hospital in the state of Michigan and it is this type of format that we utilize for all our outcomes data at all of our meetings. We have 3 one-day data meetings during the year, in addition to the 3-day summer meeting with invited speakers, as you can see, and extensive data reviews. We recognize the reality of using these opportunities to create an energized dynamic that we set ourselves to review specific data and share processes during quarterly meetings, and found this simple approach could be extremely effective. A first example in 2005 reviewed internal mammary artery use in the state of Michigan and recognized when we reviewed the data that there were 7 programs whose mammary artery utilization was under 90%. Internal mammary artery educational sessions were integrated into our meetings, as well as the creation of an IMA exclusion form for the operating surgeons at these sites to select the reason that the internal mammary artery was not utilized. These were reviewed in a feedback letter returned to the surgeons, and miraculously, over the next 3 years, these sites improved their use of the internal mammary artery. We learned several very important realities with this first foray into the unknown of unblinded data and the use of these data for performance improvement. First and simplest, we had the ability with performance measurement to create a comfortable, safe venue and opportunity to discuss results, the collaborative meeting. This was performance feedback in a public way, enabling and facilitating improvement, not judgmental, not challenging, presenting improvement opportunities and methodologies. Second, we learned performance feedback can, with a simple repetitive focus, create the moment for goal setting. And third, the changes created by performance improvement benefit our patients, our institutions, and truly reflect our commitment and professional responsibility. When we looked at other results, such as prolonged ventilation, we recognized institutional outliers and created a statewide webinar, data manager instructional sessions, and using one institution as an example from 2010, St. John Hospital in Detroit, encouraged and then followed their data. Their physician champion, Dr. Sanjay Batra, created a broad team with accountable leaders for data, result analyses, and improvement methodology. Their improvement was then presented at a quarterly meeting, and their approaches and protocols shared throughout the state. In addition, using a simple cost formula borrowed from the Virginia Collaborative and recognizing the beneficial halo effect to decrease prolonged ventilation occurring in all case cohorts over 8 years, there were dramatic financial savings. Sharing our information graciously and then stealing shamelessly, we invited Alan Speer to visit our collaborative in February 2009 and help us focus on blood conservation, a program he had successfully created at Inova Fairfax Hospital in Virginia. Following his visit, multiple hospitals in our state created transfusion review groups, and every hospital has decreased unnecessary transfusions since 2009. Thank you, Alan. During the collaborative's formative years, and influenced by the Veterans Administration Cardiac Surgery Advisory Group led by Fred Grover, and Bill Nugent and his work with the Northern New England, Frank Shannon from the Beaumont Hospitals in Michigan created a phase of care mortality analysis evaluation format that led to quarterly reviews of every cardiac surgical mortality in the state of Michigan by our quality committee to categorize, as best could be done, when the critical or sentinel thought process or care process occurred during any one of these 5 phases. And while the results over 10 years have been reasonably consistent, the preoperative phase, which includes the decision to operate, the type of procedure, and the timing of the procedure, continues to capture a third of the mortalities in our state. Noting overall cardiac surgical mortality in Michigan is 3 to 3.5% of the 11,000 yearly cases. This led into site mortality meetings, formal site visits as well as reverse site visits, and nearly half of the 33 programs have participated in these. We reviewed statewide failure to rescue data and initiated simulation scenarios, including high-fidelity perfusion crisis challenges, as well as resuscitation simulation for our intensive care units. The latter were led by the advanced practice team leaders at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, Diane Jones and Lawan Hance. And 13 of the 33 programs will have completed this resuscitation simulation by year's end. As the STS general thoracic database has evolved, and under the leadership of Drs. Robert Welsh from the Beaumont Hospitals and Andrew Chang from Michigan, we have expanded into the world of general thoracic outcomes and quality improvement initiatives. We now have 15 of our programs participating in the general thoracic database with over 15,000 procedures. As one example, we review operative approaches for lobectomy for lung cancer and have been fortunate to have Drs. Kozauer, Fernandez, and White visit and participate, noting 64% of the lobectomies for lung cancer are video-assisted. A further data review that sets the stage for potential performance improvement reveals site variation in mortality as well as complications. Understanding at this early time frame in the registry, the volumes are small. We are currently stepping into the very complicated world of congenital heart surgery with a collaborative for the three Michigan sites, led by Dr. Marcus Haw from DeVos and Grand Rapids, with the help of Hal Walters and Rick Oye. Before we move into another reality, I wish to thank the cardiac and thoracic surgeons of Michigan for their time and commitment to working to build this culture. And a thank you as well to our resourceful, committed data managers who are the foundation of much of what we do. Finally, thank you to the collaborative staff led by Ms. Patty Toyer, without whom none of this could have been accomplished. Let us now move into the other reality I initially spoke of. It's another discipline where performance and methodology measurement is an evolving science. Performance feedback, uniquely personalized, and success or failure, a transparent, publicly visible moment. The United States Tennis Association Player Development Program, based in Orlando, Florida, works with developing young players as well as established professionals. Goals are set, repeated practices and evaluations occur, and performance feedback personalized with coaches, trainers, and the player. And while they are not expected to win Wimbledon every day, targeted performance metric improvement is a clear and consistent goal. These are brief vignettes from my interviews with player development leaders and players at the USTA, revealing approaches to performance measurement, performance feedback style and timing, and reflections on qualities necessary to succeed and improve. To set the moment, let us listen to Martin Blackman, General Manager, describing USTA player development.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this role?
Sure, Rich. And first of all, it's our pleasure. But I'm the General Manager for Player Development for the USTA. Player Development is a division of the USTA that's tasked with developing American champions. As it relates to analytics, there's really been an explosion in the last 3 years. And we're very fortunate that we have a gentleman on our team, Dave Ramos, who is one of the pioneers of video analysis 7-8 years ago and has been able to learn and keep pace with the technology. So right now, using Hawkeye, using what we call tagged video, we can isolate different metrics and KPI within the performance of our top players, and then we can measure that against a baseline of high performance and show them where either they're overachieving or underachieving.
Now we listen to Roger Federer, perhaps the greatest tennis player ever, who yesterday won his 20th major. as he pays tribute to the recently celebrated master coach, Jose Higueras, who was one of his early coaches when he started to win the majors, noting Jose's skill as a listener, his willingness to share and to teach.
Hello, Jose. Roger here. Also, I wanted to just congratulate you on everything you've done at the USTA. For me, it was an absolute pleasure working with you. You know it. I don't need to tell you via a little video message, but I felt it was also important for me to just tell you that I think you're one of the great men in tennis. Can't thank you enough for everything you did for me, but also for all the juniors around the world, really, because I know you always have an open ear. You're always willing to speak and share all your information, all your stories.
Next, we hear from Jose Higueras, the recently celebrated Master USTA coach, talk about qualities and commonalities of high-achieving, successful people, always wanting to improve, always being thirsty for knowledge, followed by his views of another one of his star players, Jim Courier.
Being uncomfortable, to me, one of the big traits of very successful people is that they're actually comfortable being uncomfortable. So I think those are commonalities that we can probably put into every field an individual that becomes successful. I think all those great champions they're always thirsty for knowledge. It's always about getting better. I don't believe that they think about winning as much as about getting better, because they know that if they get better, they're gonna win more. And I think those are commonalities that apply to most of the or every successful person. But Jim Courier, for example, I don't think I've seen anybody being a better worker than he was. His intensity was amazing. He was relentless. He'll do anything. He will do anything to actually try to be the best player that he could be.
Let us listen to another great champion, Jim Courier, on his thoughts on the development of trust and the qualities of listening, as well as the importance of what he called a communication channel and the unique skills of those who provide feedback, including having a blueprint or plan for feedback.
One of Jose's great attributes is that he's a great listener. So he listened a lot to me in the early time that we spent together to understand how I took on board information and how I viewed and processed information. So that allowed him the ability to know how to communicate the most efficient way. Because there are a lot of times that someone who's a wonderful instructor might not be as good of a communicator, and some of the great notes that they're giving you and recommendations that they're giving you might just miss, because you might not hear it the way that they intend it. So one of the great things that Jose did with me early on was establish a really strong communication channel so he could get his messages across, and we had a clear blueprint for what we needed to work on to improve. It was crystal clear in my mind the areas that were good and the areas that were less good, and we were going to continue to work and hone the things that were working well and try and make them even better. But we were going to also spend plenty of time daily on the areas that needed to come up to that other level in order to make me a more well-rounded performer. I don't recall moments where I got angry with them. I would get angry with myself for not being able to perform the way that I hope to.
As we decide when and how to provide feedback, let us listen to Martin Blackman again with his thoughts on the timing and honesty of performance feedback.
Really be an active listener. Really figure out what the timing is, what the right tone is for where that player is emotionally. If a player is coming off 3 really good weeks, that's probably a time where you can hit them hard with some very direct critique, because they're feeling really good about their game, self-esteem is high. If a player is coming off of 3 really bad weeks, you probably want to be very selective and very careful about how direct you are with the feedback you give them, but at the same time, being honest.
Here's Cece Bellis, a 17-year-old, on her comfort with feedback, and as important, Lee in the second part of the video her understanding of how intense she must be to train to become a champion.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's the only way I'm going to get better is with feedback and criticism. Positive criticism.
I think...
He's been using the phrase, Cece, you need to practice a couple different shots that we do every day. You need to practice like a heart surgeon. Because if you make one mistake, I mean, you can't...
As we consider how we deal with our failures and how to discuss or present them, Martin Blackman reminds us of the most important reality, embracing our failures.
Doc, it's the same thing after a tough loss.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard stories about great players who have lost in the finals of a Grand Slam, heartbreaking losses, and 2 hours later have gone to the practice court to work on what broke down in that match. And it could be the last slam of the year at the Open, but the reason they do that, the reason their coach does that with them, is to send the message home that it's about process. And we're not going to hide from our failures. We're not gonna hide from bad outcomes. We're not gonna hide from bad performances. We're actually going to embrace them because that is the path to greatness. Is to really embrace and examine all of your mistakes, all of your failures on that road to greatness. There's a great quote by Seneca, the obstacle is the way. And that's really what we believe.
As each of these USTA leaders has described, they are focused on observation and measurement of performance, understanding appropriate feedback, taking into account when and how to provide the feedback, and reassessment of performance for improvement. The commitment of their players is unwavering, and the recognition that performance feedback is essential is understood by every player at every level. Perhaps we can learn from their commitment and approaches. As I asked myself how this became but one part of my career, I was reminded of two cardiac and thoracic surgeons who had a greater influence on me than I realized. The first was Herb Sloan. Dr. Sloan was a demanding advocate for excellence and a severe critic of failure, whether his own or ours, and he was ever frustrated with unmet expectations. The second was Harvey Bender, who shared the intensity and goals of Dr. Sloan. Dr. Bender created a Nashville citywide Saturday morning conference that he led with surgeons from the four competing institutions, offering a forum not seen before there or probably elsewhere to discuss complications and mortalities. Few, if any, could have set the atmosphere for that discussion, and clearly it influenced me. A third remembrance was that of the Sarnes Corporation, an Ann Arbor-based perfusion manufacturing company that celebrated its 25th anniversary in 1985. At their 25th anniversary, they recognized that quality in today's world is a must, and they set a goal of zero production defects, 1985. As we recall Dr. Sun's amazing AATS presidential address last spring, as well as his superb reading list, I will remind all here that the Sarnes goal predates all of those books he listed on change theory, good to great, grit, outliers, wisdom of crowds, or the end of average. Zero defects predates all, and this was a perfusion industry leader's fundamental goal. With these personal historical imprints and the evolution of the support of established surgeons and then a community of surgeons, data managers, and a payer, and clearly the financing is a benefit and creates a responsibility. Our quality collaborators, and others as well, are organizational examples of scalable clinical data for learning. It is a small view of big data science, since the data sets are rich enough, but captured, managed, and analyzed on a small scale, and are enough to alter behaviors. It has taken us from reporting outcomes to designing interventions, and then re-examining the new data as depicted in the learning cycle on the right side of this slide. Unbeknownst to us, the collaborative fits the 2007 Institute of Medicine foundational categories that probably only Dave Sheehan, our quality guru, even knew about. We certainly did not. But on this unreadable page, the learning health system, we are basically an example of that. A learning loop, which is on the right side. And this was all created, I presume, by very bright PhDs, and none of us have ever read this. Simulation, a technique. We gave you examples of that. And then high-fidelity simulation, which is repeatable. And finally, system integration. Our collaborative's role, and the role of us all, is to create seeing, and then make seeing and knowledge continuous with each other. Yes, seeing and knowledge continuous with each other. The arc of the story is actually that accepting performance feedback, looking at our outcomes, is as much about our character as our talent or ability as surgeons. And as our future tennis stars recognize, there always are ways to improve. And for all of us, while this may seem to be an aspirational narrative, the mastery of our approach, whether it is a hospital network, an individual hospital, or an individual surgeon, our professional innovation that we spoke about earlier, our seeing will create the success. And by the way, we have found the correct definition of collaboration: to labor together, to work or act jointly. Before I conclude, I purposely waited to introduce and thank my wife and children. My loving parents and sister that I have mentioned and Dr. Nauenheim mentioned were all supportive, and my father, Jacob Prager, set the model, albeit without any regard for work-life balance, of the role of a physician, and I recognize that my career tried to imprint that model. When Lori and I reconnected, nearly all the children were in college or graduate school. And as I have said to a few of you, I am the only man to be at both of Lori's weddings, and one was mine. The oldest child, Jeremy, my son, is married to Amanda, and they have two children, Rachel and Olivia. Jeremy is an associate professor of pediatric otolaryngology at Colorado Children's Hospital and a University of Colorado Medical School faculty. Megan, Lori's oldest, is an executive director of healthcare financing at J.P. Morgan, based in Chicago, and has two children, Gwendy and Paul. Eliza, my daughter, has an occupational therapy doctorate and is on the faculty at Maryville University in St. Louis, and with Dan Flanagan, they have a daughter, Eloise. Mary, Lori's middle child, I know Mary, it's tough to be a middle child, is an assistant professor of pathology at the University of Colorado, Denver Health, and is married to Dave Benson, who's here with her today. TJ, Lori's youngest, is an architect and designer who is on the faculty at the University of Illinois, Chicago in industrial design and has his own studio. Now, those who have known me over the years of my career and have known my wife, Lori, understand I would not be on the podium today were it not for her. As a mother and accomplished healthcare architect, recognizing she could handle physicians like us who thought they always had the right answers, she supported and encouraged me to take on new challenges while working full-time as a busy architect and leading philanthropic events in our communities for our hospitals and our art museum. She has been my steadfast, trusted confidant and guide and my love. Lori, you have helped make all this possible. I wish to thank all of you for taking the time to be here this morning. We have much more to do as a profession, and I am confident that we recognize and accept this responsibility with the commitment and energy we have shown through the evolution of our great specialty. Once again, my sincere thanks.